This morning we're in Genesis chapter 49, which is where Jacob blesses his children and ultimately is gathered to his fathers. So the Lord took him safely home. So it's a great way to start the session this morning. So, do you ever find yourself reading a passage of Scripture, and you read it, and you reread it, and you read it again, and you scratch your head, and you try to figure out what the practical application is for it? It's like reading through Numbers. You know, you read the genealogies, and you wonder, what am I going to do with this? Well, that was this passage for me. In fact, I would say that out of the previous 49, and even the last one, the last chapter, this was probably the most challenging passage in all of Genesis for me. And the reason is, I found myself going through it, and first off, there are a lot of exegetical challenges to it. It has to do with Jacob blessing his sons, and there's a mix. Most of your Bibles probably say that it have it titled like Jacob blesses his children, but it's actually a mix of blessings and cursings. And so that's the challenge too. But then there's some exegetical stuff with it and trying to figure out exactly what does this mean and what does that mean. Some of it's clearer than other parts. And so when you're somebody like me that spends so much time, you know, getting in and digesting this and trying to use resources to help, you know, you start turning to commentaries and others to try to help you. Like, what am I missing here? And when you turn to the commentaries on this, and they're all over the map, meaning even they struggle and are like, we're not really sure what this means. You know, so this is probably one of the most challenging. But even working through that, then kind of going, what do we do with this? Now that we figure out some of that stuff, and I've got some answers as we go in through the text, then it becomes a real challenge of, well, what do you do with this? What's the practical application for this? So, as I stand here this morning in front of you, I'm not quite as confident that the practical applications are going to be something that you're going to walk away with going, great, I'm going to run that and apply that right away as I walk out the door. But there's some good principles for us. I'm going to save those until the end. So instead of giving you some takeaways as we go through it like we often do, I'm going to save those as some general observations that we can draw from the text. So I want to first just kind of go through, and we're going to read through it, and we're going to talk about the different verses, obviously, and see if we can figure out exactly what Jacob is saying here about his sons and to his sons. And then we'll come back and we'll talk through what do we do with this? How do we apply this to our lives? What lessons can we take away from it? So I'm going to break the passage down into two sections today. The first section is basically verses 1 through 27. And that's where Jacob prepares his sons for his departure and for their future. So he's going to talk to them about what to expect, what can they expect for the future. And so from that perspective, he's making prophetic utterance. He's telling them something about their future. And then the rest of the chapter is going to be focusing on ultimately, his death, and then his being gathered with his fathers, and what his plans are for his sons. In other words, what he expects them to do after he's gone. So let's take a look at the first chunk of this, if you will. I'm going to break this down into, we're just going to follow through in the passage, mostly in order. Some of it we're going to take a little bit of out of order, but for the most part, we're going to go through it in order. But this is where Joseph prepares his sons. He's now close to death. We've already seen before that he's already met with Joseph, and he's talked with Joseph about his death. Now he's gathered all of his sons together. So they're all there in front of him. And much like we've seen with some of the other patriarchs, he's going to bless his sons before he dies. And so we see that here. And in part of this blessing is he's preparing them for what they can expect in the future. And the struggle we face with this here is that some of it might apply more immediately to them as individuals, meaning as he talks to the specific son, but some of the things he shares isn't so much about the immediate son, but maybe the son's descendants, like the tribe that they become. And so it's a mix, and sometimes it's not really easy to figure out all of that. So the first group, I'm going to say it this way, the first three are covered in verses 1 through 7, and that's Reuben, Simeon, and Levi. So chapter 49, let's look at the first son, Reuben here. Chapter 49, the first four verses. Then Jacob summoned his sons and he said, "Assemble yourselves that I may tell you what will befall you in the days to come." In other words, what to expect for their future. "Gather together and hear, O sons of Jacob, and listen to Israel, your father. Reuben, you are my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, preeminent in dignity and preeminent in power. Uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence, because you went up from your father's bed when you defiled it. He went up to my couch. So you notice the first thing he does here is he mentions Reuben as his firstborn, which was true. Normally that position would have afforded him a certain preeminence in the family and culture and society. It's a place of dignity. It's a place of strength. Usually the firstborn is charged with caring for the family after the father is gone. It's a pretty important position. And so he starts off by saying that. He says, you're my firstborn, verse 3. You're my might, the beginning of my strength. You're preeminent in dignity and preeminence in power. All of those things are true. But then notice what he does. He sort of flips the table here. Because he just said he was preeminent, but then he also says, uncontrolled as water, you shall not have preeminence. Well, what's that about? The idea of being uncontrolled as water here is the idea of almost like a boiling pot. It's almost a description of boiling water. You know what that looks like. You know, you put a pot of water on the stove, you turn up the heat, and it begins to see some bubbles show up, and all of a sudden it's a little bit out of control. That's kind of the picture. So he says that, Reuben, you're sort of like that. You're sort of like out of control. You're like a boiling pot of hot water. And because of that, you will not actually have preeminence. Now, we know what that's about because we're told here that he had slept with his father's concubine. You remember where that took place? Turn back to Genesis chapter 35. Genesis chapter 35. There's one line, and it just sort of sticks out like a sore thumb. Genesis chapter 35, verse 22. It came about while Israel was dwelling in the land that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine. And Israel heard of it. Nothing else is said. Sticks out there like a sore thumb. But it's a terrible, horrible thing. A son sleeps with his father's concubine. Now, most believe that that's probably a power thing. In fact, we see that with one of David's sons who sleeps with his concubine when he's trying to take over the kingship from David. So there's some sense of maybe a power move here. It's the eldest son, I have the right, I'm taking over my dad's estate, you know, before dad dies. We don't know for sure, but it was clearly a wicked thing to do. And so when we go back to Genesis chapter 49, we see that Jacob remembered that. He didn't say much about it at the time, but it now comes back up. And so what he essentially is saying here in these verses is that Reuben will no longer be the firstborn. He will no longer have the preeminence, the dignity of the firstborn child. He may physically be the firstborn, but he's certainly not going to have that honor because of what he did to his father through his concubine. In fact, we know that because it also tells us that in 1 Chronicles chapter 5. Why don't you turn there with me, 1 Chronicles chapter 5. When Jacob was blessing Joseph's two children, remember what we learned about that he was essentially bestowing upon Joseph's two children the firstborn status. He had made Joseph's two children his own children and essentially gave them the birthright over Reuben. And we see that in 1 Chronicles chapter 5, verse 1. It says, now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, for he was the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that he is not enrolled in the genealogy according to his birthright. So what Jacob did was he stripped Reuben of his birthright. And we see that here when he is, again, your chapter headings may say blessing his sons, but this is more of a curse than it is a blessing. There's a consequence that Reuben is now facing because of his sin, his wickedness against his father, and that he would no longer have that preeminence as the firstborn son. That will be given to somebody else. And again, it was given basically to Joseph, but passed on to two of Joseph's two primary children. So that's Reuben. That's not much of a blessing, is it? Then we see he groups Simeon and Levi together. We find them next in verses 5 through 7. Let's read those. Simeon and Levi are brothers. Their swords are implements of violence. Let my soul not enter into their council. Let not my glory be united with their assembly. Because in their anger they slew men, and in their self-will they lamed oxen. Do you remember that story? Actually, let's finish with verse 7. Cursed be their anger, for it is fierce, and their wrath, for it is cruel. I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Remember the story that he's talking about there? When their sister, Dinah, was taken, she was raped. The individual who had raped her wanted to take her as his wife, and so they approached Jacob, wanted to marry and intermarry with the Hebrews. It was the men of Shechem. Well, Simeon and Levi weren't going to have anything to do with it. But they came up with this scheme. Remember what they did? They basically said, sure, we'll intermarry with all of you folks. You just got to get yourself circumcised. So all the men in the city circumcised themselves. And it was all a ruse because Simeon and Levi were simply trying to cripple them so that they could go in and massacre them. And that's exactly what happens in Genesis 34. They went in and they massacred all the men of the city. In fact, turn there with me. Genesis chapter 34. There's a lot there, but Genesis chapter 34. This is after the circumcision had taken place. Chapter 34, starting at verse 25. Now it came about on the third day, this is while the men are healing, when they were in pain, that two of Jacob's sons, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came upon the city unawares and killed every male in the city. They killed Hamor and his son Shechem with the edge of the sword. Now Shechem, that was the one, he was the one who was guilty. He's the one that should have paid the price. But they enacted their vengeance on every man in the city, which from this perspective, they were innocent. They didn't rape Dinah. So he went and they kill every man in the city with the edge of the sword, and they took Dinah from Shechem's house and they went forth. Verse 27, didn't stop there. Jacob's sons came upon the slain and looted the city because they had defiled their sister. They took their flocks and their herds and their donkeys and that which was in the city and that which was in the field. And they captured and looted all their wealth and all their little ones and all their wives, even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, you have brought trouble on me by making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And my men, being few in number, they will gather together against me and attack me, and I will be destroyed, I and my household. But they said, should we treat our sister as a harlot? Well, we see in Genesis chapter 49 how Jacob viewed what they had done. Notice there's words like anger and violence, and they were self-willed. Those are never good things for God's people, are they? That's what they were. They were vengeful, violent men led by revenge. And again, it didn't just stop with taking out vengeance on the man who had done this, but on all the innocent men, and the wives, and the children, and the livestock. In fact, here he even says that they took out their animal, or they took out their anger, even on some of the oxen. Think about that for a moment. These guys were totally, completely out of control in a rage that they were even slashing away at animals. That's not a pretty picture. Now, he goes on to say here that because of their anger, they slew these men, but then also because of their anger, they're cursed. But notice he says, I will disperse them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Now, what's that about? Well, when it came to division of the land, we know that the Levites weren't given any land. They were given little tiny cities, but they weren't given an allotment of the land. When they went into the land under the conquest, under Joshua, the land was broken up into basically for the 12 tribes. They weren't given any of that land. That's one of the things that is a fulfillment of what Jacob says here. Now, Simeon is a little different because Simeon was given land, but what was interesting is they were given a smaller plot and it was completely within the land of Judah. They were completely surrounded. So, in essence, they were sort of made a subplot within Judah. And later in their history, the tribe of Simeon was absorbed into Judah. It didn't exist as a separate tribe any longer. And so what Jacob says here actually comes true. They're going to be scattered. And so what happens is the Levites are scattered all over Israel instead of having their own allotment. And Simeon's tribe is scattered among Judah. So what he says here actually comes true. The next son he comes to, son number four, is Judah. And it's much more pleasant and it's much more of a blessing when it comes to Judah. Look at verses 8 through 12. Judah, your brothers, shall praise you. Your hand shall be on the neck of your enemies. Your father's sons shall bow down to you. Judah is a lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, you have gone up. He crouches, he lies down as a lion. As a lion who dares rouse him up. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes. And to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. He ties his foal to the vine and his donkey's colt to the choice vine. He washes his garments in wine and his robes in the blood of grapes. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk. Now there's a lot there. This is the second longest section of all the blessings in our chapter this morning. The other one goes to Joseph. And it primarily focuses here on Judah's role as a leader in the tribes of Israel. Now remember something about Judah here. Remember, he was the one who came up with a plot to sell Joseph into slavery. We looked at this when we studied through the time where he was standing before Joseph, and we see this amazing transformation take place in Judah from this wicked, sinful son and brother to somebody who takes responsibility. He confesses his sin. He becomes compassionate and merciful. He even offers to sacrificially take the place of Benjamin. It is a transformed Judah from this wicked son to now a righteous son. And look at what we see here. He's rewarded for it. In fact, as they were traveling into, if you remember, as they were traveling, Jacob and his family back to the land of Egypt and going to Goshen, he selects Judah to be the one that leads him in. Judah's become now the leader, if you will, of Israel. Even though he's not the firstborn, it was not bestowed with those firstborn rights or whatnot, he does become the leading tribe in Israel. It's also the tribe that the Messiah comes through. Imagine that. God not only is going to fulfill his promises to Abraham in many respects through Judah, but most importantly, the biggest promise, which is a salvation. So, second longest section here, it's a true blessing on him. He describes him as a lion who relates to the tribe of Judah's role as basically being the defender of Israel. And we see that. Judah became the most prominent defender of all of Israel. He was indeed like a lion. Also describes in verses 11 and 12 that he'd be wealthy. That's kind of what you find when you look at verse 12. His eyes are dull from wine and his teeth white from milk. That's language that typically represents the idea of wealth. And so it's probably describing Judah as being an extremely wealthy tribe. And we know that when it comes to David and ultimately Solomon, who came from the tribe of Judah. Extremely wealthy. Most interesting, however, is verse 10. Look at what it says there. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet until Shiloh comes, and to him shall be the obedience of the peoples. Now, most believe that this is a reference to the fact that the Judah will never have a period of time where the king over Israel is not residing within that tribe. Now, it doesn't mean that, you know, we know there's been a period, the intertestamental period, where there was no king at all in Israel. And then during the Roman period, it was a mock king and some other things. But the idea here is that the king that rules over Israel will always and only be from the tribe of Judah. And that will get passed down. And we see that happening when it comes to David and to Solomon and then down through that line. And so we know that this is a reference to the kingship. But the king of Israel, the legitimate king, will always be from the tribe of Judah. And we know that. It'll never pass from that, it says. It also mentions the ruler's staff in verse 10. Clearly, this is a picture of kingship. And we know that to be the case. Now, the question we're going to have to look at here, and this is where I kind of mentioned earlier about sometimes with the Hebrew and in the English translation, it's a little challenging. And so there's this phrase in verse 10 that this ruler's staff and that this scepter will not pass until Shiloh comes. And you notice there's probably capitalized. Anybody know what Shiloh was in the Old Testament? Might ring a bell. Yeah, the city of Shiloh is where the tabernacle was for, I think, 300 years. Okay? And so the question you have to ask here is, well, if that's a reference to the city of Shiloh, that wouldn't make much sense. Meaning the scepter wouldn't pass or the ruler staff wouldn't pass from Judah until the city Shiloh comes. And so most reject the idea that that's a reference to the city. And because of that, most look at this and say, well, Shiloh, there must be a reference to Christ himself. But there's not much evidence because it's never used that way anywhere else specifically to refer to Messiah. So I could point at Matt, put him on the spot this morning. I don't want to necessarily do that. But if you look at some varying notes and other, you won't find this probably in most English translations, but sometimes in the translation notes and in maybe some technical commentaries, what you'll find is that there's an alternate translation of that, and it's this idea of until he comes to whom it belongs. Until he comes to whom it belongs is another way to translate the Hebrew. And Matt, I don't know if you got your arm up to share anything or not, but if you want to, you can always pipe in. Okay. So it could either be a reference to Shiloh, just the word Shiloh, the city, probably not, or you take those same Hebrew consonants, and another way to translate that is along this idea of until he comes to whom it belongs. So what is that a reference to? Well, in essence, if we think of verse 10 that way, what it would read as is, the scepter shall not part from Judah, the ruler's staff also would not depart from between his feet, until the one to whom it belongs appears. That's a reference to Christ. That's a reference to the king. So I guess we could say Shiloh there represents Christ, but not in a direct sense, meaning, again, I would have preferred the translation here if they would have just done this in the English. The scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor the ruler's staff from between his feet, until the one to whom they belong comes. That would be probably a better understanding of that verse. And that's important to us because if you look at Psalm chapter 72, verse 8, I'll just read it. May he also rule from sea to sea and from the river to the ends of the earth. That's a reference to Messiah coming. He will rule. Psalm chapter 108, verse 8. Gilead is mine. Manasseh is mine. Ephraim also is the helmet of my head. Judah is my scepter. That's where my king will be, from Judah. Jeremiah chapter 23, verse 5. Behold, the days are coming, declare the Lord, when I will raise up for David a righteous branch, and he will reign as king and act wisely and do justice and righteousness in the land. The Old Testament promises a Messiah who will ultimately be the descendant of David, will take David's throne, and will rule from Jerusalem. So what Jacob is prophesying here is that a time will come where that scepter, that ruler's staff, will pass from just a plain, simple, earthly descendant of David to, ultimately, Christ as a descendant of David. Because the scepter and that ruling staff ultimately belong to Christ. And so this is a promise that ultimately Messiah will come and will take his seat on the throne and will rule from Judah's tribe. Turn to Matthew chapter 1. We see this in the New Testament as well. Matthew chapter 1. I won't read through these, but remember, Matthew gives the genealogy of Jesus for a very specific reason. To prove that he is a descendant of David and has a right to David's throne. And so when you look at the genealogies, it begins in chapter 1 of Matthew. The record of the genealogy of Jesus, the Messiah, the son of David. And you go all the way down to the last verse. Jacob was the father of Joseph and husband of Mary, by whom Jesus was born, who is called the Messiah. In other words, what Matthew does, he starts off his gospel by basically saying, Jesus, the scepter belongs to him. The ruling staff belongs to him. He's the descendant. He's the one Jacob prophesied. The one from Judah, descendant of David, who is the Messiah and has the right to the throne. And from there, we find what we look at in Luke chapter 1 when he talks to Mary. Turn there real quick. Luke chapter 1, when the angel comes to Mary, jump down to verse 31. We'll start at 30. The angel said to her, "Do not be afraid, Mary, for you have found favor with God. And behold, you will conceive in your womb and bear a son, and you shall name him Jesus. He will be great and will be called the Son of the Most High. The Lord God will give him the throne of" what? "His father," his descendant, David. "And he will reign over the house of Jacob," what? "Forever, and his kingdom will have no end." That's a fulfillment of what Jacob told Judah. At some point, Messiah will come because the scepter and the staff to rule are his. And until then, there will be a succession of kings in Judah that will lead up to that. And that's exactly what we see historically. And so we find here in this section on Judah that the focus primarily is sort of twofold. One, Judah being the lion who will protect Israel, which we see throughout the Old Testament history of Israel. But more importantly, it's the one through whom the Messiah will come, the one, the real king who will ultimately take the throne and rule forever. Pretty cool. Now, the next six sons, plus Benjamin, are sort of a mix of various blessings and fate. Some of them are real simple, some of them are a little more complicated, but you have the sons Zebulun, Ishkar, Dan, Gad, Asher, Naphtali, and Benjamin. And again, it's a mix of sort of various blessings. If you look at Zebulun in chapter 49, verse 13, Zebulun will dwell at the seashore, and he shall be a haven for ships, and his flank shall be toward Sidon. What's really interesting about that is it seems to imply that Zebulun, the tribe, would be right along the shore, but it's not. In fact, he was surrounded by other tribes. He wasn't anywhere close to the water. Some critics will say, see, the scripture's wrong here, because it says that he will dwell at the seashore and shall be a haven for ships. Well, that is a challenge, because again, his tribe was not along the seashore. But what's interesting is that he happened to be smack dab in the middle between the Sea of Galilee and the Mediterranean Sea, and it just so happened to be right along the most important route between those two. And so basically they would even travel ships sometimes across that. And so it may be that we're supposed to understand this not as him literally being positioned at the shore, but being positioned between two very important, probably the most important bodies of water in all of Israel. And again, they were right along that maritime. So it was actually, they became a maritime tribe. In fact, there's evidence that they even built ships. And so, again, he's just sort of laying out what it'll be like for the future. Again, I think the challenge there is because it does say he'll be along or at the seashore, but sometimes the descriptions given are not always to be taken in a specifically literal sense. You know us here, we are literalists, we take the scriptures literally, but sometimes that means you have to look at it in the context and understand, well, does that literally mean they'd be up against a shore, or does it mean that they would be a maritime close to two shores? And that's probably most likely, at least historically, that's what we see here. What about Ishkar? Well, verses 14 and 15. Ishkar is a strong donkey, laying down between the sheepfolds. When he saw that a resting place was good and that the land was pleasant, he bowed his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. Now this one's a little hard to understand because there's no real agreement how we're supposed to interpret the donkey picture here. One, the donkey could be a positive symbol, meaning that he would bear these, you know, burdens and he would be really a hard worker because donkeys, you know, can work hard. But it could also be a negative picture because it depicts this donkey lying down between its burden and its work, trying to find a pleasant resting place to lay down. And there's no consensus as to really, is this a positive picture or a negative picture? Maybe it's both. Don't really know. Verse 15 is also a bit of a challenge, partly because of the way that it ends. He bows his shoulder to bear burdens and became a slave at forced labor. That seems to suggest, that translation seems to suggest that Issachar's descendants would become slaves. Problem is, there's absolutely no historical evidence that they ever became slaves. What's interesting about this is the Septuagint translation of this actually translates it differently and says that they would become tillers of the ground, which they were. They were all farmers. And so there's some question there. Sometimes the Septuagint translation is just a Greek translation of the Old Testament. Sometimes they give us a slightly better rendering of what that may mean. And you can. The word that's used here to be forced into labor could also mean becoming a farmer. And so the question is, which of that? Most English translations do something with it having to do with maybe some forced labor of some kind. But again, there's no evidence that that ever happened. But there was evidence of agricultural work. So could be either. Doesn't tell us much about his future aside from that. But what about the next son, Dan, verses 16 and 17? Dan shall judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heel so that his rider falls backwards. What's interesting about this is, anybody know what tribe Samson was from? Samson was a judge from the tribe of Dan, probably one of the most well-known from the tribe of Dan. It says here that he would render justice to his people, which is something Samson did. There may have been other judges that came from the tribe of Dan. That seems to be what Jacob is saying here. Just because their names aren't necessarily listed in the scriptures doesn't mean that there weren't additional judges. There were many judges, some that fought the battles like we see in the book of Judges, but they were throughout Israel to judge the people of Israel. The interesting thing about this to me, though, is this phrase that they would be a serpent in the way, a horned snake in the path. When you get into that, it seems to suggest that they would be a stumbling block for others. And what's interesting about that, and I don't know for sure if it applies to this or not, but Dan was one of the first tribes to get involved with idolatry. They became a snare for the other tribes. There's some reason to think that since Jacob here is describing language that suggests they're like a snake in the path that you don't see. I love to watch Gunsmoke in the morning when I work out. And this morning's show, Matt Dillon, the marshal, was riding out through the wilderness with Kitty. And she got spooked because her horse came across a rattlesnake. She didn't see it. Knocked her off her horse. That's a snake in the grass. You don't see them. And so the fact that they would bite at the horse's heels and the rider would fall backwards is not a positive thing here. And again, it may have something to do with the fact that Dan was the first to fall into idolatry and led much of Israel into idolatry repeatedly, not just once. So that, in some respects, would be more of a curse than a blessing, right? What about Gad? Verse 19. As for Gad, raiders shall raid him, but he will raid at their heels. Now, Jacob describes Gad's future here as being plagued by raids, which is kind of fitting because they were one of the tribes that settled on the other side of the river. They didn't want to be in the land with the rest of them. They wanted their own land on the other side, which put them at risk for being attacked by others. And they were often. And so it put them at more danger. They would be raided more often. Historically, that appears to be the case. But the other part of it is that it also seems to suggest here, it says, but he will raid at their heels, which many believe means that they would also be very good at raiding their enemies. And what's interesting about the tribe of Gad is they, even though they were on the one side of the river, they often came to the rescue of tribes on the other side. They were always the first to show up. And so, again, this may very well be what he's describing here, that yeah, you'll put yourselves in danger, you'll be raided quite a bit, but you will also be raiders yourself. And again, evidence, and historically we see that they did indeed always come to the defense of their brothers across the river. How about Asher, verse 20? As for Asher, his food shall be rich, and he will yield royal dainties. Kind of an interesting one. What we know about Asher is that they were given land in the far northern part of Israel, which is where some of the most agriculturally lush and rich parts of Israel were. And they were small, but they were a fairly wealthy tribe, and they were known for food. And so it appears here that he says that they'll be the ones providing food, delicacies for royalty. Historically, you know, I don't know that there's any evidence that they delivered food to David or Solomon, but that appears to be what Jacob is saying here. And again, they were in a very lush, agriculturally rich part of Israel. How about Naphtali, verse 21? Naphtali is a doe let loose. He gives beautiful words. Again, a bit of a challenge. A doe let loose might suggest speed or agility, especially from a military perspective, and that was true of Naphtali. Giving beautiful words, I think, is a reference to prophecy. What's interesting about that is Deborah, remember Deborah the judge? She came from this tribe, and we have actually in Judges chapter 4, verses 4 and 5, says that she was a prophetess. In addition to that, we have her song recorded in Judges 5. Interesting. He says here that Naphtali is going to be a tribe that gives beautiful words, and we see that with Deborah being both a prophetess and somebody who recorded a beautiful song for us in the scriptures. How about Benjamin, verse 27? If you want to jump, we're going to jump through a bunch of scripture here. We'll come back, but go down to verse 27, which is where Benjamin is given. Benjamin is a ravenous wolf. In the morning he devours the prey, and in the evening he divides the spoil. The way that describes him as a ravenous wolf is generally interpreted to mean that even though he was one of the smaller tribes, he was a military force that had to be reckoned with. And he was. They were specifically known for their skill in archery and slings. King Saul and the apostle Paul were both from Benjamin as well. I think about Saul in the New Testament. He was fierce, wasn't he? I mean, even in his persecution of Christians beforehand, but even in the way that he attacked the gospel and just went forward witnessing, he happened to be from the tribe of Benjamin, and maybe ravenous wolf might describe him as well. The longest blessing in all of this section here actually was reserved for Joseph. That's verses 26. Read that with me. Joseph is a fruitful burrow, a fruitful bow by the spring. Its branches run over a wall. The archers bitterly attacked him and shot at him and harassed him, but his bow remained firm and his arms were agile. From the hands of the mighty one of Jacob, from there is the shepherd, the stone of Israel. From the God of your father who helps you, and the Almighty who blesses you with blessings of heaven above, blessings of the deep that lies beneath, blessings of the breast of the womb, the blessings of your father have surpassed the blessings of my ancestors, up to the utmost bound of the everlasting hills. May they be on the head of Joseph, and on the crown of the head of the one distinguished among his brothers. Now this is an interesting blessing because, if you think about it, Joseph, out of all of his sons, was the most ill-treated, mistreated. You look at the opposition that he faced. His brothers all hated him. He's basically taken out. They try to kill him, throw him in a pit, then they sell him off to slavery. While he's in slavery, he happens to be in the house of Potiphar, gets accused falsely of rape, ends up in prison, spends 10 years or whatever in prison, languishing. And yet, what do we know about Joseph? His faith and firmness held strong. And that's exactly what Joseph says here. His bow remained firm in verse 24, and his arms were agile, and his hands of the mighty one. He even attributes Joseph's ability to stand firm to the mighty one of Jacob. This is a great depiction of who Joseph was. There's not really much here in terms of his future, except that he prays that the blessings of the father would remain on Joseph. So those are the blessings that he passes on and some of the cursings to his sons as he prepares them for their future. And I would think that it might have been an encouragement for some, maybe a challenge and a rebuke for others like Simeon and Levi and Reuben. Maybe they would listen to his words and realize that maybe their behavior, we've talked about this before, you know, they ended up living for another 70 plus years or so in Egypt alongside Joseph, and the impression we get is that it's peaceful, things have been brought back together. Maybe they took note of what their father had said, and maybe it changed their lives. We don't really know for sure. But through that, he lays down these blessings and, in some cases, these cursings and warnings for his sons. And then it ultimately leads him to prepare them for his death and to give him, give them his final wishes. And that's what we find in verses 28 through 33. 28. And these are the 12 tribes of Israel. And this is what their father said to them when he blessed them. He blessed them, every one, with the blessings appropriate to him. Then he charged them and said to them, I am about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite, in the cave that is in the field of Machpelah, which is before Mamre, in the land of Canaan, which Abraham bought along with the field from Ephron the Hittite for a burial site. There they buried Abraham and his wife Sarah, and they buried Isaac and his wife Rebekah, and there I buried Leah, the field and the cave that is in it, purchased from the sons of Heth. When Jacob finished charging his sons, he drew his feet into the bed and breathed his last and was gathered to his people. Joseph knew his death was imminent. He had already talked with Joseph about making sure that they would bury his bones back in the land of Canaan, not there in Egypt. He made that absolutely clear to them. You can go back to Genesis 47, verses 29 and following, and read that. That had already been established. They were already aware of that. Essentially, he repeats the same thing here to them. Verse 29, he says, I'm about to be gathered to my people. Bury me with my fathers in the cave that is in the field of Ephron the Hittite. So he repeats his desire to be buried back in the land. And I know we've stressed this multiple times. I don't think it's necessary for me to repeat it, but I think it's important. What he's doing here is it's a declaration of his desire to see God fulfill what God had promised. God's promises were back in the land of Canaan. They weren't in Egypt. And remember, things had gone really well for them in Egypt for the last 17 years. But his heart was back in the land. Why? Because that's where God's promises were. That's why he wants to be buried there. And yeah, granted, he wants to be buried with his family. He wants to be buried next to Leah. He wants to be buried where his father and his grandfather were buried. But it's more than that. And you see that as we've studied through this, especially last week. That's where God's promises were. And so for him to say, I want to be buried back there, is his commitment to see God fulfill what he had promised. And we saw that as clear as day, where he basically makes Joseph swear to him. He says, swear to me that you'll do this. That's why it's important. That's why when he says here to his sons, take me back there. It isn't just, I want to be back where mom and dad were. That's where God's promises were. In fact, we know that that's exactly what they do, is they take his bones back, and that'll be next week. They bury him back in the land of Canaan. It's all about God's promises. God had repeated to Jacob on multiple occasions his promises. He says, behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not forsake you until I've done what I've promised to you. He says in Genesis 31, return to the land of your fathers and to your relatives, and I will bless you there. He says in Genesis 46:4, I myself will go down to Egypt with you, and I myself will bring you up again. Those are the promises that God repeated to Jacob. In fact, when Jacob is talking to Joseph in the last chapter, he says, God will be with you, and he'll bring you back to the land with your fathers. Jacob knew that God would in the future take all of Israel and bring them back to the land. That's why their burial ground was back in the land of Canaan. That's where their family will be. And that's what he was committed to. That was the charge given to his sons. So what do we do with all of this? What do we do with these blessings and everything else? The first principle I think we can draw from this is the concept of consequences and rewards. If you think about it, he had a mix of sons. And we look at his challenge that he gave to Reuben. Reuben was stripped of his right to be the firstborn. There was a consequence for his sin. If you look at the consequences for Simeon and Levi, they had done a wicked, wicked thing. And their consequence was that they were going to be scattered throughout the land. They would not receive the same type of inheritance that the other sons were going to be given. So there are consequences for sin, and we see that laid out here as a principle. But we also see the principle of rewards for faithfulness. The way that he talked with Judah. Judah was an individual that to me is rather cool because he's a lot like us. He was wicked. God convicted him of his sin. And then we see the transformation that took place. And as a result, look at how he's rewarded. The scepter, the ruler's staff would not depart from his descendants. The Messiah would come through his descendants. That's a pretty amazing reward for somebody who responded appropriately, repented of sin. He wasn't perfect, but he repented of that sin and was transformed by God. You think about Joseph and Benjamin, the blessings given to them. Probably the two most faithful, apparently, of Joseph's children. Joseph especially. And the blessings that he receives and the rewards that he receives because of that. And so one of the things we can draw from this is the same principle we see throughout the scriptures. There are consequences for sin, and there are rewards for faithfulness. Plain and simple. And that's true in terms of eternal or for ultimate eternity. The consequences of sin is separation from God and the lake of fire. Come to Christ, place your faith and trust in Him. The reward is eternal life, is it not? But it's even true of us believers in this life in many respects too, because as we live our lives, there are consequences when we sin, aren't there? Certainly we pay the consequences for sin in this life, but there are also rewards. Old Testament tells us that the way of the wicked is difficult. Okay? It's disheartening sometimes to see people who profess to know Christ, who don't live like it, and you look at their lives and they're just a mess and just a wreck, and they wonder why. Because there's consequences for the way that we live. And so this principle we can see here is just a simple principle we see throughout the scriptures. There are consequences for sin. And there are rewards for faithfulness. It comes along with the Lord's blessings. Another principle I think we can see here. You notice that Jacob's sons were far from perfect. And yet, God's whole redemptive plan involved Israel. I was talking with somebody about this a week or two ago. God's whole redemptive plan goes through Israel. That is not popular today. I've talked about the growing anti-Semitism even within the church. This rejection of Israel. God's done with Israel. Tossing Israel aside. You know? And yet, God's whole entire redemptive plan goes through Israel. It started with the calling of Abraham, promising him physical, earthly promises, including a kingdom that'll be everlasting, but also spiritual promises that through him all the nations will be blessed. So there are physical and earthly as well as spiritual promises. What do we see happen throughout God's redemptive plan? Ultimately, Jesus Christ comes, okay, offers us salvation. But what do we have yet to be fulfilled? God still promises he's going to fulfill those earthly promises with Jesus Christ sitting on his throne for 1,000 years. We'll get to participate in that at some point. It still goes through Israel. It still involves Israel. We get grafted in. Most recently, I was discussing with somebody online. They were talking about how God is completely done with Israel and how Gentiles get grafted in. And I said, grafted into what? Oh, grafted into the church. I'm like, go back to the text. It says that Israel is the tree. They're the olive tree. We are grafted into them. They're not grafted into us. But he didn't see it that way. And so I think about that, and I look at this from the perspective here, is that God did that with imperfect people. The foundation of Israel were the 12 tribes, the 12 sons. But they were not perfect. Some were kind of wicked. Some were much more faithful and beloved. God worked with them. We saw the conviction of some of those sons take place a couple weeks ago where God was working on them and convicting them of their sin. God uses imperfect people to accomplish his plan. Tie that now into the church. Are we perfect as the church? Come on, be honest with me. Of course you are, right? We're all perfect saints?
Only you.
Thank you, honey. No. Isn't it interesting how God uses imperfect people to accomplish his purposes? And it's because he's sovereign, but also because he's gracious and merciful. Now, that doesn't mean he doesn't try to work out some of the perfection in us. We're actually told, and we're going to get into this book of James, the reason God allows us to struggle through trials is because he's trying to perfect us, make us perfect and complete, lacking in nothing. Right? He's always working on us, but he still uses imperfect people. And we've seen that as we've gone through Abraham, Jacob, and Isaac, or Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Interesting. They were not perfect people, were they? But that's the way God works. Thank God for that. And so as much as I vent on the shape of the evangelical church today and how it's frustrating when we look around at our churches filled with Christians who aren't living like it, who don't know much about the Bible anymore, churches or pastors are doing TED Talks instead of teaching from the Word of God, and it shows. As frustrated as I get with that, what's interesting is God is still using the church to accomplish his purpose and his plan. Imperfect people. How? Don't know why, because that's the way God is. But there's another principle we see here. And so as we look at what Joseph and the others are facing here as their dad is blessing them, they were imperfect people. And that's who God uses. The third and final principle that I think we can draw from this is that Jacob's ultimate hope wasn't really in the earthly promises. And we know that if we, and you don't have to turn here, but Hebrews chapter 11, verse 21 says that by faith, Jacob, as he was dying, blessed each of the sons of Joseph and worshipped, leaning on the top of his staff. It was an act of faith when Joseph blessed his children. But even goes on a little further. Look in chapter 49, verse 18. There's a verse we skipped over. And it's, again, one of those verses that just sort of sticks in there and you wonder why it's there and it's easy to overlook. But Genesis 49, verse 18, you notice something? Right smack, not deliberately in the middle, but in the middle of this discussion of his blessings, look at what he says. For salvation I wait, O Lord. Did you catch that when we read through it? Out of nowhere. He's blessing Dan, and then he just simply says, before I get to Gad, for your salvation I wait, O Lord. What was he waiting for? Was he waiting for the earthly promises? No. I'm waiting for the salvation. I think he knew something about the promises made to Abraham. The author of Hebrews tells us that Old Testament saints like Abraham, Isaac, Moses, Jacob, Samson, Gideon, David, all the others, they placed their ultimate hope not in the earthly promises God had made, but in the heavenly one. Something none of them would experience in their earthly lives. I believe when Jacob was blessing his sons here, that even though he was telling them about their future and was looking forward to what God would do in bringing them back to the land, his focus was on the Lord's salvation. Not on the earthly stuff. Shouldn't the same thing be true of us? Hey, there are a lot of perks to knowing Jesus in this life. Would you agree? Sometimes God blesses us in this life. I shouldn't say sometimes. He always blesses us. Sometimes he really blesses us in an earthly sense, does he not? But should that be where our focus is? In fact, that can become a distraction, can it not? Far too many Christians get caught up in the blessings we receive here. There's a whole entire segment of the church that focuses purely on the health, wealth, and prosperity that God brings about, right? But that's not where our focus is supposed to be. We're right now supposed to be looking for the coming of Christ, for Christ to come and take us home, for the rewards that come afterwards. We're told that we will reign with Christ if we're faithful. That's where our focuses ought to be. And that's what we see here in Jacob. And one little verse that sticks out. I look forward to your salvation, Lord. That ought to be what our heart is. I think that's probably the biggest takeaway from this section here. I just couldn't preach on that one verse all morning. But that's really what it's all about. Our focus ought to be on salvation. And that ought to really be reflected not just in the things that we appreciate and enjoy here. Jesus himself told us that the treasure and the heart kind of go together. If our real focus is on salvation, then we'd probably put more energy into seeing God's kingdom developed and built and sharing the gospel and sharing Christ and our experiences with others than we would on building wealth on this earth, would we not?